Join us as we listen closely to voices that still echo from our nation's past. Distant, even obscure, but all the more exciting for that mystery. It's where fascinating women discuss fascinating women's histories. I'm Tzipporah Weinberg, and this is Veiled Reference. Let's take a deep dive into pockets of history preserved in our Torah sources. With each episode, we'll travel back in time to discover and recover stories of women who might have otherwise been lost to us. Piecing together the tales of these women of old can help us to understand periods of time that we've only hazily conceived of before. It's time to let these women's voices rise to the surface through the sources left to us, and to learn about the lives they led, and maybe draw inspiration and strength to empower each one of us on our own journeys. When Veiled Reference was still just an inchoate glimmer, when the idea to create a podcast based on Jewish women's lives in the historical and rabbinic record was barely formed, the very first name that came to mind was Glickel Bas Yehuda Leib, perhaps better known as Glickel of Hamelin. Glickel's 17th century manuscript of 330 pages comprises the first full-length autobiography written by a Jewish Ashkenazic woman. Her work, which she did not name or classify, represents an extraordinary document of Glickel's state of mind, the knowledge she accumulated, and the particular perspective of one Jewish woman reflecting on her life, her Jewish life, amidst the tumult of that particular time and space. We are extremely fortunate to have this document in our midst today, as it has become a goldmine for historians who have unpacked and framed Glickel's words and contextualized them for a deep understanding of Jewish life during this era. We are at least equally fortunate to have one of the foremost historians of early modern history with us here today, and her presence elevates this conversation to dizzying scholarly heights. We're not just talking about Glickel. We're talking about Glickel with Elisheva Karlbach, who is Salo Wittemeyer Baron Professor of Jewish History, Culture, and Society at Columbia University. Elisheva's award-winning books include Pursuit of Heresy, Rabbi Moses Haggis and the Sabbatian Controversies, Divided Souls, Converts from Judaism in Germany, 1500 to 1750, and Palaces of Time, Jewish Calendar and Culture in Early Modern Europe. This book is a must-read for enthusiasts of the Calendar Controversy mini-pod episode here on Veiled Reference. In fact, Elisheva reviewed Sasha Stern's book on that controversy, which we cited in that segment. All this in addition to numerous articles, way too many to list. Thank you so much for being with us here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me here and for inviting me to talk to your audience. It's a pleasure, and I hope one of the things we're going to do is to put the life of Glickel into a larger context so that we can begin to learn about what Jewish women's lives were like and why this particular period is significant. I want to state at the outset that my remarks are focused on Western Ashkenaz. So that means not Poland, but somewhere between Amsterdam and Prague, spanning the East-West divide and maybe Hamburg and Northern Italy, which was in this period a Yiddish-speaking Ashkenazic cultural sphere. So that's what we're focusing on. And I also want to state at the outset that I am working on a project on the lives of Jewish women in this cultural realm with a colleague in Israel, Professor Deborah Kaplan, and many of my remarks draw on our joint work.
And there's so much there that you've done that we are so privileged to be able to get a glimpse of today. For our listeners' context, with this episode, we move out of the medieval period that we've been spending time in until now and into a new era, the early modern or pre-modern period. And this stretches from approximately 1500 to 1800. You call this period of transition neither fully medieval nor yet bearing the hallmarks of the modern. What changes for Jewish women can we notice as we move from the medieval to the modern period?
So I want to speak about some structural things that come into focus in this period. One was that this was the age of what you might call the Kehillah Kedosha. Not to say that there were no Kehillos before, of course there were, but they become far more hierarchical, formal. There's elected leadership. Self-government of Jews reaches a new height in this period. And what we're about to say about Jewish women, including Glickl, places them at the heart of the function of a Jewish kehillah. So that's one thing I wanted to say. We have more information about it, but they really come into their own in this period. In the modern period, joining a kehillah is voluntary. You can belong or you can leave. In the early modern period, it was not. If you wanted to remain Jewish, you had to belong to a kehillah. And one of the side effects of these very organized bureaucratic kehillos was that they kept written records. Tremendous numbers of written records from this period have survived into our own times. In general, scholars like to call them pinkasim, which just means notebooks. But again, they appear in all kinds of formats with all kinds of subjects, but they contain amazingly detailed records, all kinds of written records about the lives of Jewish people in this period, including thousands of Jewish women and various aspects of the lives they led. So that's a second thing that comes into focus in this period. There is no Pinkas Kehillah from earlier than, say, the 15 teens or 20s at the very earliest. Nothing like that survives or maybe even existed in the medieval period. So that's a new thing in the early modern period. And finally, you can look at this period of time almost in any connection without thinking about the emergence of print as a new technology. And that changes everything in certain ways. Print means that when a person davens from a siddur, it's a siddur that anyone or almost anyone could afford, as opposed to the medieval period, where it meant owning something that was written on very expensive to produce parchment by a very intense process written by a scribe. Only the very well-to-do could afford to own a siddur in the pre-print era. By the time you get to 1600, they're very affordable, which means that women who previously would not have had the opportunity to really learn Jewish literacy from a text, now there are all kinds of books available. Sidurim and Chumashim and many different collections of Midrashim, both in Lashon Kodesh, but also in their vernacular, which in this region was Yiddish. There are, again, hundreds of titles in Yiddish that were published, both Divrei Kodesh, but also Divrei Chol, all kinds of stories and mises. And these provided women not only with material to read, but also with an incentive to learn to read. So all of that changes from the medieval period and allows us to say things about the lives of Jewish women in this period that we couldn't in any previous period.
So now we're getting already a picture of the milieu in which Glickl's memoir comes to life. And what she shares with us is really a very personal story, her engagement as a child, really, her long and happy marriage that follows, the 12 children she births and is so proud of, so worried about, her business dealings throughout all the events of her life. Beginning to end, we feel the emuna that she leans into and she expresses. She also shares the sadness she feels after her husband's passing. In fact, sharing the reason that she writes is to chase away that melancholy caused by his death. That's how she copes and how she carries on for the 30 years in which she revises the work. But today, we're talking about Glickl's work as a historical document. It's one of the few prominent memoirs written at the time, including Megillah Sefer by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, that reveal a great deal about Jewish life. Now, from your work, we learn, and from the work of other historians, about Jewish societal conditions, the roles and reach of Jewish women within and without of their households, the concerns and worries that religious women had at the time. And as you've already begun to explain, we're hearing about women's level of education from the topics in which Glickl was conversant and from the learned quality of that vernacular, that Yiddish, that is peppered with psukim and ma'amarei chazal. But the tendency among historians, at least of the modern era, until pretty recently, was to look at memoirs and ego documents as less than reliable, less than official literature, less than bureaucratic records or second and third person accounts of events as they unfolded. Why is this? Is it because the scarcity of memoirs in this time was such that we accord significance to these other documents. But do you think today's memoirs, like Holocaust documentation, should be subject to additional scrutiny for their accuracy? How do we look at documents such as these personal or ego documents?
So thank you for that wonderful question. It's really very important, and it goes far beyond Glickl or even any memoir to the question of how do we evaluate historical sources when material, written texts incised on stone, it doesn't really matter what the medium is, but when material carries a message forward to us over time, how do we evaluate it historically? This is a really important question. So the first thing to remember is that human beings are fallible. Anything we write is liable to have some kind of either distortion or error or bias, sometimes conscious and sometimes not so. Anybody who reads the newspapers these days understands that you can read one newspaper and get one view of the world and one account of events, and you could read a different newspaper and get an entirely different view of the world and a different account of the same events. How is this possible? We know this about eyewitness testimony in the legal field. Two people witness the same episode, the same incident, the same accident, or whatever it is, and they have very different accounts of what happened. So what do we do about that? How do we value these precious testimonies to the past without allowing them to distort our sense of what happened? So I want to say about some of these memoirs, what makes a person write down an account of their lives? And how do we look at that? Glickl was writing as an individual for her children. She writes for her descendants. She wasn't writing it to be published, even though we can learn so much from it. It was a very rich document. But there's no question that she was writing not only because it was a therapy to cure her sadness at the loss of her life partner, Chaim Hamel of Hamelin, but also because she wanted to explain to her children how she and Chaim, who built such a life of prestige, was a kind of leitmotif throughout her writing. But she ended up as a very poor widow, having made a disastrous, or in her opinion, disastrous second marriage later on in her life. Her furniture was thrown out on the street. She was evicted from their home. Her second husband had to declare bankruptcy. How did she go from the stage that she had been in to the state in which she found herself in at the end of her life? I think part of her memoir is also to explain to her offspring what happened, how righteously she conducted herself, and nevertheless, certain things beyond her control dictated this end to her life trajectory. So she has a motive. She's picking incidents out of her life, again, some of which do fit into this pattern and some of which answer other things. But there's no such thing as a memoir that's absolutely objective. It's a selection of impressions and things that happened that she felt were important to explain whatever it was she wanted to explain. One of the ways we can weigh such documents is by seeing what else we have that can corroborate some of what she says. And I want to give you one example of something that she writes about. Her second marriage moved her to the city of Metz in France, where she was very unhappy, to be sure. And she writes about a fight in the Ezras Nashim, in the women's section of the shul in Metz, on Simchas Torah. And she writes it was a terrible thing. And sometime later, there was a terrible stampede in the same shul in Metz, and several women died. She says it was on account of that terrible fight that Hashem punished us and brought that terrible calamity to our shul. What she doesn't say is that her husband's daughter, her stepdaughter, was one of the instigators of that fight, which was a terrible fight in the Ezras Nashim. She says people began pulling off the caps from one another's heads. It was a physical fight. They were demeaning each other verbally and destroyed the whole Simchas Torah proceedings. She gives a very interesting account of it, but it's subjective and she leaves out something that would have tainted her own family. So that's just an example of how we have to approach it. Everything she says in it is true, but it's selective. There are things that she doesn't say.
How do we find that other corroborating evidence? Where did that come to life?
So we're lucky that she lived in an age of tremendous documentation. So if you look at some of the documents about Jews in Metz, we find her second husband's family and much about them and why this fight erupted. It had something to do with their husband's business partnerships. It's just a small fact that historians were able to evaluate against her account of it. And there are other such things, small details that she leaves out. And you could say exactly the same thing for Reb Yaakov Emden's Megillas Sefer, which you mentioned. And his is, you know, very directed towards achieving certain goals. And it includes certain things and omits certain things. So we always have to read with what historians call a little bit of skepticism, a hermeneutic of skepticism. We have to ask ourselves, you know, does this carry through with all the other evidence we could possibly marshal? And sometimes it could take decades or even centuries for us to be able to look at the same text and evaluate it with different eyes.
And that's a particularly sleuthing kind of quality when you're comparing texts that way and you're finding, let's say, pinkasim that corroborate the story in that way and you can match up personae. That's the fascinating part that you spoke about, being able to trace Glickal's stepdaughter, this woman, to be the instigator in this event, which fascinates me. And I think that the idea of women being instigators in cases like this where their husbands were involved in different dealings or different matters would be something that would be worthwhile learning more about. The ability to have that healthy skepticism is also very interesting for our listeners, because these documents are not sacred documents, they're memoirs, and we're allowed to delve into them with that kind of questioning eye. And in fact, it can be very exciting for readers who wish to do so. In terms of creating these memoirs as well, and you're making us aware that there is the framework of the author's choice, really, in deciding what is historically significant, not only how to record it and who to omit, but what to include. And in Glickal's case, there was so much emphasis on business dealings, like you mentioned, this Chaim Shel Osher V'Chavod, that she speaks of the losses, the gains, and her own interventions in her husband's business. This theme of money is almost on a literal level the primary one within the work. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay. So I want to say a few things about money. One is that if possible, people should not buy the old translation into English of Glickal by Marvin Lowenthal, which is the one that I was introduced to Glickal through and had been used for generations of people. Because as Lowenthal says in the beginning of his work, he cut out all the little Musser stories that Glickal included because he didn't think contemporary audiences would be interested. So what's left are several things. First of all, Glickal was very enmeshed in her husband's business life to the point where she says multiple times, we were partners fully and completely. And we know that to be true, not just of Glickal, but of many Jewish couples in this period. We're pursuing whatever commercial interests they were pursuing, needed both partners' full participation. Very often, the husband might have been the one to go on the road. The wife would tend to the business from the home, but she knew every detail of how the business was conducted. She gives us her own several instances of this. When Chaim, her first husband, passed away after many decades, but still a young man because she married early, she was able, she said, to pick up the business exactly where it left off without there being any issues of her, you know, not like today you sometimes hear somebody say, oh, I never wrote a check in my life. I don't know how to. She knew every aspect of it. And we know this because there's a wonderful little, it's like a sentence in which she says, there was some debate about my husband going into partnership with a certain potential partner, and they were, you know, haggling over various details. And finally, I said, you know, we need a contract. We need to write down the bylines or guidelines by which we will conduct this partnership. And my husband said, I'm so tired, I can't do it anymore. So I sat down and wrote the contract. Mm-hmm. So here's a person who is not only literate and not only writerly, because reading and writing were not the same thing in those days, but also somebody who could write a business contract. She knew the legal terminology, she knew the economic terms, she knew what was, you know, the language of SOCRIM and their, you know, all the commercial ins and outs. So this was very much at the center of her life. And one of the things business people have to do is keep good records. So writing on a continuous basis is something that she had probably practiced. I wish we could find, you know, the books that she kept for their business, which would give us so much more insight into what her life was like. But she was a writer in that way. And therefore, many transactions that she writes about, she writes about their value, every shidduch she makes, how much the natin was and how much it cost and how they traveled and what they served and, you know, who was there as a guest. All of this was important to her because when you are a business person, things get translated into economic value. And that's something that you see in Glickl. But I also want to mention that in many cases, when contracts are drawn up, they're drawn up between the male partners and the women are generally omitted. There were things that were done halachically in this period to try to ameliorate that omission, because very often even the money came from the dowry that a woman brought into the marriage. And these were halachically significant issues in almost any transaction that either the man or the woman made. But the records tend to emphasize the role of the men. And one of the things we like to do is try to use someone like Glickl to understand that they were really two full partners to many of these transactions.
And that really brings us to the question. We discussed on an earlier episode that Doña Gracia Mendez was basically elided from the historical record as a person of influence. Can we assume that there were others in this case, like Glickl, who were equally talented, equally influential, at least in their husbands' businesses, that were not preserved in historical sources?
So I'm going to change that question a little bit. They were preserved in historical sources, just nobody pays attention to them. and that's one of the things we hope over time, as the records of Kehillot become more available to scholars, but even to lay readers alike, we see how prominent women were in the life of their communities by name, that they're not anonymous in many cases. We know who they are. We can trace them sometimes in various types of documents, for example, registers of who gets married and how big their dowry was. That's something that Kehillos had to measure for various reasons and record. But also in their wills, we have dozens of wills written not just by men, but by women. We have Sifrei Zikaron, or Memor Bisher, as they were called in German, or Memor Bisher, as they were called in Yiddish, in which people paid to have the name, like an obituary, but the name was read out on the Shabbos of the person's yard site, aloud in shul. And many women, you know, their families put in very detailed accounts of some of the things that they did within the kehillah, the chesed that they did, the tzedakah that they did, the women who were miyaldos, who ran to help other women when they were giving birth, the women who had yeshiva students at their tables for decades. These are services and participation by women by name that we could trace hundreds, if not thousands, of women. There are Memor Bisher that go for hundreds of years. And each year there are dozens upon dozens of entries, which give us a much more robust picture of how a kehillah could never have functioned without what women were doing, really at the center of it. So in the kehillah records, it sometimes just says, you know, this balabas took X number of bachrim, you know, for this many weeks. doesn't say who actually cooked the food, right, bought the food, served the food, cleaned up. That doesn't get mentioned. In a Memoirbuch entry, it might say, I'm just making up a name, Sarah Leah said Bufram at her table and the poor every Shabbos, or so on and so forth. So we see the other side of what the record doesn't tell us.
And again, we're matching that up. So it's those entry
right,
points.
We try, yes. And then we can look at Matzevos. So those that have survived, very often they tell us something when a person was born, sometimes when they died. Right. Other details, Matzevos become much more elaborate in this period, where in the medieval period, there were two or three lines. Now you sometimes have long, almost Megillas on a Matzeva, which are very helpful to historians.
Even for women, describing yes. women's deeds.
Same thing. Again, especially for wealthy women, because these were expensive things to produce. The higher the socioeconomic class, the more we can learn.
And still with the same care as Matzevos are written with today, to be faithful to the truth of the nifter or the nifteres? Or is there more leeway when a wealthy person is involved and the tendency to be more effusive on the Matzeva than waxes forth?
I have never seen a Matzeva that said this was a mean, ugly person. They all, without exception, say something laudatory, whether it's poor or rich. And I also want to say one other thing, which is we can learn about poor women from things like tzedakah rolls. The Gabbai tzedakah very often kept very careful records because they were, after all, tasked with distributing tzedakah. My colleague Deborah Kaplan wrote an entire book called Poverty and Charity in Early Modern Germany. And what she shows there is that we can really see who the poor were, both men and women, and how tzedakah got distributed on the basis of various factors, who was considered either a worthy poor person or at least part of the kahila membership, and how differently people who were not blessed with those kinds of credentials sometimes don't get tzedakah.
Mm. Well, by the wayside, as it were. You had mentioned earlier that women wrote their own wills. Do we see as well as we had, let's say, during the Cairo Geniza period, that women relied upon others to create those forms for them? Or were the women at this point more and more literate and writing their own wills? How can we be sure?
We can be sure that nobody, including most of the men, authored every line of the will, because like today, a lot of it is what you call boilerplate.
Yeah.
You have to say that you're of sound mind and body and you are appointing the following people as witnesses. This is all boilerplate. Where you could see a woman's will come through are in the specifics. When they leave certain objects, certain clothing, certain whatever it is, specific things in their material lives, but also their spiritual will. This is their own directive. And that it's clear they are either writing or dictating to somebody who's taking down their own words and wishes. So one might be able to say it's a kind of co-authored document.
And even so, even if they're not actually the scribes of these documents, we are finding out so much beyond the intellectual history of this material culture and the material history, the social history that you focus on that really enriches our picture of the women of this time.
Yes.
And we turn now to the question really of education. Women in our audience, very interested in topics, the history, the rabbinic literature, and women with Beis Yaakov backgrounds that stoked a thirst for knowledge and curiosity in all of us. We have to ask, what did Glickl know and how did she know it? Was her proficiency in Chazal and Tanakh memorized? Was it something that she gleaned through reading these books that now were so popular? And how about women in lower economic brackets? Did they have access to the same sources of knowledge that Glickl did?
That's a great question. And I wish we knew even more than the paltry amount we do know. Glickl says that her father hired a tutor for her. And there were many kahilos in Western Europe in particular that didn't have schools for elementary age children, except the Talmud Torah for the very poor. It was the obligation of parents and specifically of fathers to educate their children. And very often it was teenage bachurim who become the melamdim, the tutors for the children of everybody from the middle class and up. They would come into the home, they would teach the children of various ages, whatever the appropriate texts were. And then very often the very most brilliant children, especially of the males, would go on to Yeshiva Gevoha and the rest would go into business. So Glickle says that her father hired a tutor for her and her siblings. She also mentions in passing that during a particular war that erupted, her Seder studies were disrupted. I don't know what she means by that. There is no mention in other sources that I have found from this period of a Seder in Hamburg where she was growing up. So I just don't know. But maybe there were what we might call off the radar, small chadarim for girls. I simply don't know. What we do know is that she was an avid reader, having gotten the tools to be able to read, which not everybody could. Not every woman could. She was an avid reader. She read Sifrei Musar. She read all kinds of things in Yiddish translation. She went to shul every Shabbos. She had what she called a Shabbos Frau, which is a female Shabbos goy, who carried her children to shul for her so that she could be near them if necessary. And that meant that she probably followed along both in Kriyas HaTorah, but also the Tfilos themselves. So she knew, and we could see from her writing, she was extraordinarily literate in Midrashim and in Sukkim and many other things that she read. There are whole scholarly articles about what Glickle knew. The question really is she extraordinary or ordinary in that way? And what I have found is that there are two classes of women that were Jewishly very literate. Families of Talmidei Chachamim, Rebbetzins and their daughters, who grew up in homes full of learning and books, whether they were wealthy or not, tended to be extraordinarily Jewishly literate. And the other class are the upper, middle, and upper classes, where tutors could easily be hired to teach them all kinds of things, including, again, Jewish literacy and writing, which were two separate subjects. So Glickle really fits into the latter category. Her family were not particularly rabbinic, but they were very, very learned and literate in Jewish things. And that's because they could afford to be. Poor women didn't necessarily know how to read and or write, and sometimes only in very rudimentary fashion. We found, for example, women who signed their name when they received a certain amount of tzedakah, they were supposed to sign that they received it. They write a circle. They couldn't write their name.
Not the proverbial X. It was actually
right.
A circle.
That's right. Yeah.
Is there any significance to that?
I think it was just what was accepted. And then underneath that, the scribe writes, you know, this will be in the place of my chasimas yad, of my own handwriting. Was signatures. So that was just really very moving for us to see.
And at the same time, we know you've written and spoken about at least one other woman who was educated enough and talented enough to be a writer, a woman who wrote the introduction to her husband Sefer, memorializing her children, and whose letters to her husband are still extant. And that's Bella Perlhefter. We also know of Rivka Bas Meir Tichtiner, whose book Meinekes Rivka predates Glickle Bas Yehuda Leib. And we assume she read that as one of her sources of knowledge. How would their writings add to our understanding of what women could reach and achieve in the early modern period?
So just in very brief, Rivka Tichtiner's Meineket Rivka was the first full book authored by a woman to be printed. She prepared it for print, but she didn't see it in her lifetime. Some years after she died, a printer took it to press. And he writes, this is an amazing thing that a woman could write a sefer like this all on her own. She wrote it all on her own. It's a sefer musar, a classic of how to be a Jewish woman at the head of a household and how to be machanech your children and your servants and how to serve your husband. Some of it, again, somewhat boilerplate and some of it very uniquely from a woman's perspective. She does not go into any halachic details about anything. She does not teach, for example, Taras HaMishpacha. She possibly didn't want to get in trouble with the rabbanim of her era who might have objected. And maybe she, you know, I don't know if that was a conscious choice or not. But some of the things that she does, as the editor of a modern edition notes, are really from a woman's perspective. For example, when she talks about candle lighting on Friday night, she does not bring the midrashim that say Chava brought mortality and darkness into the world, so women have to compensate for that. To her, it's all positive. Women bring the spirit and joy of Yahadus into the home, and she wants to emphasize that positive spirit. So I think, you know, that's something that she, Rivka Tiktina, brings. Bella Perlhefter lived 75 years later, and she's almost a contemporary of Glickl, a very interesting person who wrote a great deal. She was a true writer, and she writes about herself as a writing professional, you know, almost like an artist or a painter. She says, you know, what we do is art. It's not even just putting word after word. I believe that her role in the Be'er Sheva, which was the name of the encyclopedic work that for many years was attributed only to her husband, but she writes an acrostic, you know, the way many authors do, where the letters of her name are spelled out in the very beginning in a poem. And it's Bella Tzin Rabbi Yaakov Perlhefter. I mean, her husband actually took her last name. She wrote in several different genres. She wrote parts of the Be'er Sheva, including its entire introduction. But I also think that there are places where you could see her hand in the compilation. She wrote that she was a professional letter writer for other women. So there are many things that we don't have from her. A few of her letters were preserved by a non-Jewish scholar of her time. I actually saw those originals in the city of Leipzig. They're really very moving and very nice to see. And she wrote Jewish lieder, poetry songs for women to sing. And she told you which melody to sing it to. So she contributed a great deal. There are many other women. Women wrote trinos. Women wrote other things that we have. And again, there's probably so much that wasn't preserved because people, and maybe women themselves, didn't feel that they were valuable enough to preserve for posterity. But there's much more to be said on the subject.
We've already learned so much in our brief time together now that we've deepened not only our understanding of Glickl, but of the entire context and what women could achieve during her time period. So now let's learn just a bit more in our Lifting the Veil segment about this day and age and this time and place. All of our modern Jewish history buffs, our audience, are aware of the impact that the Carlbach family had in shaping Orthodox education in the period after the Second World War. The Chavatzelet School, which was the first school to introduce systematized Orthodox education in Warsaw, was founded by Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Carlbach, and the Real Gymnasium in Kovno, which served as a model and inspiration for the Yavne school system, was established by Rabbi Dr. Yosef Carlbach and his brother-in-law. These institutions shaped formalized education forever after, and these brothers were your great uncle and your grandfather, respectively. And this is the legacy that you received. Was there a sense of mission that you felt that informed your studies and that you can share to inspire all the young enthusiasts out there that want to keep learning and growing?
So I just want to say that my father, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was a masterful machanech. Anybody who had him as a Rebbe never forgot him. Even though he was a teenager, he was sent to the concentration camps. He was torn from his own father and mother at a very young age. He was a teenager. But they left an indelible impression on him that still reverberates through the generations. And the message that my father gave us was that simply there was no nobler profession than teaching Torah. It didn't matter to which age and at which level. This is what sustained him through the most difficult imaginable period in Jewish history, personally, and it's something that he gave us in every breath he took in his entire hanhaga, you know, kihem chayenu ba'orech yomenu, and this is something, you know, that we all absorbed. And I just want to say a brief word about my mother, who passed away just a few months ago, Zichrona Tzadekes Levracha, who sacrificed everything in her life to enable my father to pursue this dream, which left them with very little in terms of material resources, but such a rich spiritual atmosphere. And my mother was one of the early American Beis Yaakov girls. She was born in Germany, but came to the United States as a little girl and went for high school to Beis Yaakov of Williamsburg, which was very pioneering of her in that age and in that world. And something that I noted after her passing was this little picture of Rebbetzin Vichna Kaplan that she kept on the kitchen wall behind a door her whole entire life that I remember. And it's the one thing that I asked my siblings if I could take after her patira. It just said so much to me about what her guiding star was. And therefore, I do want to say to anybody of the Mishpacha audience who are listening, Al titosh Torah imecha, the influences that we got from our Beis Yaakov teachers are very important and significant. And our community doesn't really value chinuch habanos enough. I'd like to see a mora get paid as much as a rebbe. I'd like to see us understanding how important these roles are. Again, for our kahilos, for our collective, it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so very much. I would also like to point listeners to the incredible testimonies that I use in my classroom when I teach about the Holocaust that we have of Rabbi Kalibach, which are available on Witness to History's CD-ROM and also through Steven Spielberg. They are life-changing. And it has been such an honor and a privilege to speak to you. And I thank you so much for being here and for the gift of your time and your scholarship.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Veiled Reference. Enjoy this episode and share it with your friends. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear from you at podcasts@mishpacha.com. Veiled Reference, a Mishpacha podcast.